The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform. You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 20th of January 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, the US Supreme Court rejects a final attempt by Donald Trump to block access to more than 700 pages of documents relating to the Capitol riots. We'll have the latest. Then we'll be casting an eye across the stories making front pages in Latin America.
I'm Lucinda Elliott, Monocle's Latin America Affairs correspondent, and today I'll be taking a look at extreme weather in the southern part of South America that's causing blackouts, heat waves, and floods.
More from Lucinda a little later. Also ahead, the day's business headlines with Ewan Potts from Bloomberg, including a major reshuffle at Disney. And it's Thursday, which means our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here with his weekly Global Countdown. What do you have for us today, Fernando?
Hello, Tone. Today we're heading to a country with a vowel-rich capital. Stay tuned.
More from Fernando later as well. All that ahead here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. We start today in the United States, where the Supreme Court has rejected a request by former President Donald Trump to block the release of White House records to the Congressional Committee in charge of investigating the January 6th Capitol riots. Well, I'm joined now for more on this by Julie Norman, who's the co-director of University College London's Centre on US Politics. And alongside me here in Studio One is Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermack. Chris and Julie, good afternoon to you both. Julie, let me actually start with you. Just bring us back up to speed here. What happened exactly? What are the documents in question this ruling was concerned with?
Sure. So the congressional panel in the House that's investigating the incidents of January 6th has been trying to get access to some of Trump's documents for months. This is to investigate the lead up to the riot on January 6th, as well as how the riot played out and also Trump's lack of actions that day. Trump has been claiming executive privilege, which is a tradition in the United States that means that the president's communications are not usually up for public review in this way. This has gone through several other lower courts and came to the Supreme Court. And so the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that indeed in this situation, these documents were so important that they overrode the usual executive privilege and could, in fact, be turned over to the committee.
Yeah, hugely significant. And Chris, let me bring you in, I guess, on that sort of point. Why is this so critical? More than 700 documents, we understand, made available. Do we have any sense of what the investigators are actually hoping to find within this cache of documents?
Well, maybe it makes sense to back up a little bit on that to say what this committee is trying to investigate. There's a number of tracts to it, but really the cores are... One is looking at the day itself, right? January 6th, the insurrection, the security lapses, how this could have happened, how people got into the Capitol, and sort of the very specifics of that day and who was involved sort of on the day, those who are many who have been charged and are, even sent to prison for their role in it. The second part of this investigation, though, is the politics, if you will. Who encouraged the riot? Who expected it to actually infiltrate the Capitol? Was there a plan to infiltrate the Capitol? Who knew about that, if so? And related to that, you know, the whole question about the election. Who was attempting to actively subvert the election result? Who was attempting to prevent Joe Biden from taking office with claims of election fraud, as we know Donald Trump has made consistently and consistently continues to make? And that's really where these 700 documents are so crucial, if you will. On that second point, what did Donald Trump know? What was going on in the White House in the run-up to and on the day, as Julie said there, exactly what was his role? Was he supporting this? Was he encouraging, even though he publicly eventually told those supporters to go home? Was he rejecting that in the run-up? There were hours there where he was not telling his supporters to go home, not commenting on the riot in that sense quite as openly. So what was happening behind the scenes in the White House? And yes, even further, you know, this is what we don't know. Was he aware of what might be happening ahead of January 6th as well? These are all the sort of open questions about who knew what exactly and how much of a role did they have in it.
Well, Julie Norman, let me ask you specifically then about that point as it relates to Donald Trump. What kind of a blow is this to his, well, this campaign to keep these documents out of the spotlight, and then more broadly to his, you know, wider political ambitions? I guess we can't know until we see or learn more about the content of the documents specifically on that latter point, but it must be, it's certainly a blow even in terms of his 24 ambitions, right?
Well, it certainly may be. And again, this was the last attempt to block these documents from being released. I think Trump was counting on some of the justices he had appointed to the Supreme Court to maybe have his back on this. And in this case, we saw those justices, abiding by their own virtues and integrity of office and letting these documents go forward. So he's at the end of the road with the documents. What this means for him moving forward, though, is still quite up in the air. It's important to note that the House committee is not a criminal prosecution kind of committee. They're investigating the incidents of that day and what led up to it. But what they can do is make a criminal referral to the Department of Justice if there is indications of wrongdoing. So the big question in Washington around a lot of the Trump documents is, will there be enough here to encourage a criminal referral to justice regarding Donald Trump himself? If that is the case and justice decides to pursue it, that's really the only path by which Trump could legally have charges against him that would affect him running in 2024. Obviously, there could be political repercussions that could also affect his prospects for 2024. But the way that we have seen his base and his supporters reacting to the events of January 6th and reacting to the committee, my sense is that the political repercussions itself would not be enough to stop him. It would only be if it went to legal action, which is, again, quite further down the road from where we are now.
Maybe just to jump in on that point, Julie, I think one of the things, though, that is perhaps interesting for me to say is that it feels like Republicans in the U.S. have walked a very fine line, if you will, of sort of acknowledging that January 6th was abhorrent, was something that should not have happened, but at the same time saying that we should not overly focus on it, that it was a dark day in politics, but it was not the work of shady political forces, whether in the White House or sort of, you know, higher ups, if you will. It was not encouraged by politicians and was essentially just a protest gone wrong, if you will. So I guess that's where I wonder if this comes out that Donald Trump was more intricately involved in some way, or other members of the administration were intricately involved, knew what was happening, and even encouraging it, that could be quite politically damaging, even if there isn't a legal referral.
Well, yeah, and this is something that I find interesting, which is the degree to which this is everything in this space is political. But Julie, let me ask you, is there a reassurance, maybe because of the ruling of the court in this instance, that this is a satisfactorily neutral and objective investigation that continues, and that actually maybe even with the polarized US political spectrum, we can avoid kicking this around as a political football and just be quite rigorous, and, you know, this investigation into the, you know, upholding of democratic values offers a bit of a, I don't know, an opportunity maybe for the Capitol and for the whole of the system to sort of reassert the values at its core? Is it a bit early to say something positive like that?
I think it might be a bit early. At the same time, it is important that the judiciary has stayed independent, has maintained their integrity through this. And that is, you know, key for U.S. democracy right now. In other institutions, there's a bit more worry around them. But I think what we're looking at now, I mean, again, from much of Trump's base point of view, the committee is and has been, a very politicized operation from their point of view. That's not the way most moderates see it, most traditional Republicans see it, but most of Trump's base see it that way, as kind of a gotcha operation. And that's the way that Trump has been framing it. So that has been part of his rhetoric in trying to not release these documents. And so I do think that image is going to persist, even though the committee itself has been operating in a very respectable kind of format. But as to Chris's point, I mean, a lot will just obviously depend on what actually comes out of these documents. There were over 750 pages released, and they range from everything from Trump's daily diary to draft texts of speeches that he was planning for January 6th to calls with election officials. So there's a lot for the committee to go through. And, you know, I think the response and the response from both the right and the left will just really depend on the content that's released in these documents.
Well, yeah, given that context then, Chris, what's the next key thing to look out for? Do we just have to await pronouncements exactly as Julie's described then, once we have a more forensic scrutiny of what is contained on these pages? Is there another date in diaries? What do you think is the next key indicator as to how things are going to shape up?
Well, in short, yes, I think we just have to wait for the committee to now do its work. This is, as Julie said there, a number of documents that they have to look at, hundreds of documents. There's also still a question of who else will appear before the panel. There have been various senior members, such as Mark Meadows, former chief of staff, and also Steve Bannon, who are being held in contempt of Congress, potentially, because they're not appearing before the panel. So the panel still has to do a lot of work on that regard. The one thing I just say to end is what's been so striking about this, and it'll be interesting if the committee can make any inroads on this, is the fact that it's worth noting that both sides in this, rather surprisingly, if you will, see democracy at stake, right? Two-thirds of Republicans also, who believe that the election in 2020 was a fraud, believe that democracy is at stake as a result. So both sides are, if you will, passionate about democracy in this, even if half the side, you know, Democrats and most moderates, as Julie said, believe that this was something that was an attempt to subvert the election. And the other side believes there was, you know, believes Trump's claims, unfounded claims of election fraud. It will be interesting for me to see whether the committee can make any inroads on that, pushing back against those claims by perhaps exposing certain comments that Donald Trump made to show that he was actually intentionally trying to subvert a process, and just how unfounded those claims were.
Yeah, interesting stuff. We will be watching very closely in the days and weeks ahead. That was Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak. Just before that, London-based US political expert Julie Norman with her insights too. My thanks to them both. 12 minutes past the hour. Let's hear from Monocle's Marco Sippi, standing by with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Tom. The US President Joe Biden says he thinks Russia will make a move on Ukraine and that Moscow would pay a serious and dear price if there was a full-scale invasion. Speaking at a news conference at the White House, Mr. Biden stressed he does not want a full-blown war. The first flights carrying fresh water and aid have arrived in Tonga today as the Pacific Island nation continues to assess the aftermath of a huge volcanic eruption and tsunami. Workers and volunteers have helped clear ash from the main airport runway so that military transport from New Zealand and Australia could land. German prosecutors have opened an investigation into the two leaders of the Green Party over special coronavirus payments. The probe is looking at Robert Habeck, the economy minister in Germany's coalition, and the country's foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, for a possible breach of trust over illegal payments in 2020. And finally, green laser pointers will be distributed to residents of Sunnyvale, California, to help deter a flock of more than 1,000 crows that have been gathering in the town over the past 5 years. You can find out more at monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines here on Monocle 24. Now, Tom, I was wondering if you may have have any tips or tricks for getting rid of any unwanted birds in your backyard?
Well, I was going to ask you the same question. Are crows, do crows menace the residents of Helsinki or Siilinjärvi for that matter?
I think it's more about seagulls in Helsinki. Crows in Siilinjärvi, where I come from.
Would you fight them off with a laser pointer or something more robust? Because I happen to have it on very good authority that you are a certified deadeye marksman, as officially endorsed by nothing short of the Finnish Army. Well, will you confirm or deny this?
I have to deny for now, but I've definitely been considering that sometimes when I've been fighting with the seagulls, I've been trying to steal my ice cream at the Helsinki Central Market Square.
There you go, listeners. Don't tell me that we don't bring you the big important news stories from around the world. Marcus, thank you very much. Indeed. It's 21:14 in Tokyo, 13:14 in Zurich. But right now we're crossing elsewhere in the city of London for a business update. Our good friend at Bloomberg, Ewan Potts, is standing by. Ewan, look, the big return to the office begins again here in London.
Yeah, pigeons and foxes are the things that we have trouble with where I live in London. But on the subject of returning to office, here we go again. It's all happening again. Certainly in London, it is back to the office again. Less than 24 hours after the UK government relaxed restrictions on COVID, it says it's getting rid of pretty much all of COVID restrictions. One of the first major economies in the world to move in that direction. Be very interesting to watch how things pan out in the UK from the rest of Europe. In the Netherlands, they are still in quite a severe mode of restrictions. Many other countries also have a lot of restrictions in place. But in London and in the UK, they are going. Citigroup, the big US bank, has emailed its staff telling them to get back in the office. They'd like their staff to be in at least 3 days a week. In an email to staff, they say, "We're now free to gather in offices where we're better able to generate the energy and collaborative spirit on which Citi thrives." Bloomberg's also spoken to investment giant Fidelity and to Standard Chartered, another London-based bank. They are both also asking their staff to get back in the office less than 24 hours after that announcement from Boris Johnson. PricewaterhouseCoopers reckons that the return to office will be rather speedier than last time. Remember, it was quite a gradual transition back to working from the office last time. It took his firm 2 months to get back to 80% capacity. He reckons it's going to ramp up rather quicker this time. Citibank, though, does point out that it's still offering flexible working and have protective measures in place. It asks its staff to get tested with lateral flow tests 3 times a week.
Let's talk a little bit about chips, Ewan, which has been a bit of a perennial for us, hasn't it, over the last sort of year or so. The world's biggest maker of chip making machines, well, they've got a problem.
Yeah, it's quite surprising, this, isn't it? When I first read this, I thought there must be surely some mistake. If you're making chip-making machines, this must be a very good time to be operating. But ASML, an enormous Dutch multinational, world's biggest maker of semiconductor-making machines, has got a bit of a problem. It is having problems getting chips. These are the chips needed to make the chip-making machines. The company says it's in a daily fight to secure chips for itself. And, of course, without the chip-making machines, we can't sort out the chip problem. And the chip problem is really pretty bad. Nissan is the latest in a string of car makers who've been sounding the alarm as we go into another year of another chip shortage problem. Toyota has slashed its production target by almost 150,000 cars and says it's going to be very difficult to achieve its full year target. We're only 2 weeks into the year, so car makers really struggling to produce cars. And that's having an interesting knock-on effect on the inflation figures in the UK and the US and in many other economies. One of the things which has been really rising in price is used cars, and that is related to the chip shortage. Because there aren't enough new cars around, used cars have been soaring in price. In some cases, nearly new cars cost more than their new equivalents, or something that I don't think has ever happened before.
No, really interesting. And we need to obviously add chips to the sort of chicken and egg quandary, right, when it comes to chip making machines, Ewan. That's just blowing my mind. Let's wrap up, though, with the story I mentioned right at the top of the show. A bit of a shake up at Disney. What have you got for us?
Yeah, it's all to do with streaming. Walt Disney is shaking up its streaming management. It's also forming a new hub for international content creation. Now, Walt Disney saw torrential growth in sign-ups following its rather well-timed debut of this Disney Plus streaming service in November 2019. What happened a couple of months after that? Lots and lots of people signing up to buy Disney's products and watch them at home. Things have rather slowed down now for Disney and for the other streamers as we all get on with doing more interesting things than watching The Box. And Disney also caught up in production issues. A lot of shutdowns, of course, during the pandemic. It's very difficult to make programs. So the programming flow has been rather halted. Disney has been relying on releasing cinema films direct to Disney Plus, direct to the streaming service. That's provided quite a boost. But the pipeline is a little bit limited. Something else we're watching in the streaming world today, Netflix have their earnings later on today. The stock has been a gift to investors. It's risen 48,000% since 2002. But the bad news is the closely watched subscriber additions number is looking like it might miss the company's estimate. They reckon that the subscriber growth grew by was 8.5 million over the last quarter. We reckon that's going to be a little bit shy of that number.
A bit of a Mickey Mouse figure, one might say. Ewan, thanks as always for joining us. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts joining us here on The Briefing. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. Time now to get a roundup of stories making the news across Latin America with our correspondent in the region, Lucinda Elliott, who I'm delighted to say joins us now from Montevideo. Good morning to you, Lucinda. And I wanted to start with, start with the weather. Reports of extreme weather, including severe droughts and floods, bring us up to speed.
Yeah, so Argentina and Uruguay were just praying for rain this week as a record heat wave hit this part of the world. We're talking temperatures of 43, 45 degrees centigrade, but the feeling is much more stifling, and practically all of Argentina, including Patagonia and neighbouring countries like Uruguay, southern Brazil and Paraguay last week experienced their hottest days in history, according to weather services. And the drought has triggered actually a cut in forecasts for the soybean harvest, which, as we know, this part of the region produces a lot of soy. And now the rains have finally come. So severe flooding was reported here in Uruguay earlier this week. You had sort of rubbish dumpsters and cars floating in parts of the capital, Montevideo. And this follows on actually from floods in Brazil at the start of January. So some really extreme weather events as we begin the start of the year, and obviously all attributed to climate change.
Yeah, it's a pretty alarming picture. And I know that we've been seeing citywide blackouts in the Argentine capital, Buenos Aires, as well. Is what we've seen in BA, is that also attributed to the extreme heat?
Yeah, so in some of the most upmarket parts of the city, there were power outages for up to 48 hours due to a surge in the use of air conditioning and fans that totally overloaded the system. In fact, the government even had to send state workers home to save energy in large office buildings. And that blackout also pointed really to Argentina's economic crisis. I mean, energy in the country is heavily subsidized by the state, and electricity companies have not been receiving competitive rates, therefore not investing in the infrastructure. And when days like last week occur, and they were widespread, I mean, I'm talking about 11 million people without any light or a fridge, and there are thousands still this week without power, the system entirely collapses. And China, in fact, announced an investment in the sector coming to the rescue with a deal signed by China Electric Power. And for many, these outages really are signs of history repeating itself. Argentina is currently in negotiations with the IMF to restructure its debt, and it's heading potentially towards a financial meltdown. And what more evidence do you need when all the lights go off?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to ask you a bit more about another story making headlines in Argentina, where China is also a factor. And that's a bit about the Winter Olympics, which was a story we talked about on our programme, The Globalist, earlier today, actually, on Monocle 24. President Fernandez, one of just 10 heads of state who will head to the country for the Winter Olympics early next month. Why so, Lucinda?
Well, since he took office in early 2020, Fernandez has been pushing for an official visit to Beijing, but then obviously the pandemic arrived. His timing, however, with this is quite curious. So while officially it is to go to the Olympics and to discuss the Belt and Road Partnership, which Argentina is not yet a member of, the visit coincides with an extremely sensitive and poignant time when it comes to negotiations with the IMF, of which the US is the biggest shareholder. And this is all coming to a head in March, which is when Argentina is due to pay $2.8 billion to the fund, money the government says it doesn't have. And so risks go into arrears. And China could be a possible plan B. It is, of course, only speculation. But as I mentioned, you know, the Chinese came in to turn the lights back on. And if they can't agree on something with the IMF soon, then Buenos Aires may be sort of fishing around for other options and ways to finance itself if a default happens.
Now, we almost got through a whole one of our check-ins, listening without talking about COVID and related developments. But we have seen some moves. Obviously, people are watching global travel green lists and red lists. And the country's been removed from the EU's travel list this week. Just bring us up to speed with that and anything else sort of COVID-related on your patch.
Yeah, so daily cases are up and up in Argentina and also in Uruguay, but generally the death rate has remained pretty stable. Most who find themselves in the ICU are not vaccinated, although I've actually been looking into some of the figures and a big chunk have had at least two jabs. Here, most people have had, in Uruguay, have had China Sinovac doses, and in Argentina, they've had Russia Sputnik. But broadly, there are issues in the region in the case of testing, you know, huge lines for people to confirm whether they're infected. And the EU, as of this week, has encouraged countries to close their borders to any flights from Argentina, particularly Spain, which is where most connections to Europe fly in. And of course, we're in the height of summer, so people are out and about, and they say that it'll basically peak in February ahead of Carnival.
Lucinda, always terrific to hear from you. Thanks for your time today. That was Monocle's Latin America Affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, joining us on the line from Montevideo. You're with The Briefing here on Monocle 24. It is exactly 25 minutes past midday in London, and in Ouagadougou, it's 25 minutes past nine in Sao Paulo, which I mention because Fernando Augusto Pacheco is here. It's global countdown time, Fernando. The hints have been flowing thick and fast, but where are you taking us, Fernando, this week?
We're going to Burkina Faso. And Tom, I think it's the first time I'm going to Burkina Faso. There's not many first times these days here on the Global Countdown, but I've never been there to literally, actually, and neither in the Global Countdown. But they have an interesting music scene there as well. As you know, it's very cultural capital. They have one of the most important film festivals in Africa, in Ouagadougou as well. So, you know, there's lots to discover there.
And we should say Monocle, of course, has long been to Ouagadougou, both for the film festival and for other reports. I think you diligently looked this up for me, Faye. Was it way back in 2013 or something, our culture show?
Exactly. Just go to the monocle.com website, type Ouagadougou, you will find there the Monocle and Culture special episode on the film festival.
So we have been there before, but not, as you say, in Global Countdown terms. So let's kick off. We start, as always, with number five. What have you got for us, Fernando?
They're not from Burkina Faso, actually, this artist. They're from the Ivory Coast, or Côte d'Ivoire, or Costa do Marfim, if you're from Brazil or Portugal. It's K.S. Blum, and he is a gospel superstar. As you can see, he's also in the Burkina Faso charts. It's funny because it's gospel, and you would imagine a certain type of song, but I think it's kind of gospel you can dance to. Shall we have a listen?
I think we should.
It's K.S. Blum with Enfant de Dieu, Child of God. Tu jamais, c'est quel problème qui le fait reculer? Il ne ment jamais, c'est quelle promesse il veut pas assumer? Je suis son enfant. Do you see the beat?
I quite like that.
I quite like it as well.
And then we took it away just as it was coming in. But that nice. It does have a slightly more, yeah, there's a sort of a pleasing gospel character there, which I rather like, Fernando.
Very pleasing, quite positive. You know, I was looking at the lyrics. I mean, it's what you expect from that beat. Hello, hello, happiness. God never fails. The Holy Spirit touched into us to win the nations. So it's quite epic as well, in a way.
And I like, Faye, that for once, it clearly doesn't have to come with a parental advisory, as your translations normally do.
Oh gosh,
this
yes.
Segment.
Last week was quite a.
Let's not go back to that.
Let's not go back.
It was too upsetting for me. Number five, K.S. Blum, big tick from me. Gets the Tom Edwards endorsement. That will, I'm sure, mean a great deal to K.S. Blum. What's number four?
Number four, a change of pace and change of country as well. She is from Burkina Faso, indeed, and she's one of the leading stars. There's a style called Afro-urban music. There's a lot of rumba, which is kind of the rhythm there in Burkina Faso.
very different track from the one that we listened before. This track is called Dudu, which means teddy, like teddy bear. The song is by Tanya. Let's have a listen.
So, Faye, would you say, is that the kind of the current sound of Burkina Faso, of the Burkina Faso charts?
Very much so. Quite a modern production there as well. Even though, Tom, I have to say it's a breakup track. So don't be fooled by the title Teddy, you know, like, or Dudu as the proper title. And her previous song was actually a massive hit as well. This was called Sugar Daddy. So, you know, we're talking about X-rated here. Probably she's a little bit more X-rated than Enfin de Dieu, our former previous song.
So she had
well.
A big hit about a sugar daddy and then another big hit about a breakup.
A breakup with the title of a teddy bear. Very interesting.
So maybe the whole sugar daddy thing didn't go that well.
Exactly. We could be. Could be.
What's
could
the
be.
Narrative? Okay, let's move along. What's number three?
Number three, what I like about Burkina Faso as well, there's a lot of African countries here in the charts. And number three, we have one of the most successful music artists from Congo. He's 47 years old now. He's Roga Roga and his band as well, which is called Extra Musica. And the song's called Bokoko. Let's have a listen. Gaela Tikaya La Patrona, Gilda Sambendengesi, Mon ami Gaël, Miloito.
I like that one, Fernando.
I like it as well. I love the percussion. I love it. Doesn't need any kind of electronic beats. It's just perfect the way it is. And you know, Tom, he's really important. He's got a knight of the Congolese Order of Merit as well.
Wonderful stuff. And can I say, I like that he's flying the flag for the 40-somethings.
Of course. Of course. I think that's a big trend in music. It's not only about...
I'm not saying I've got a vested interest. I'm just saying I like it.
And this song talks about the ancestrality in Africa. This song is really about African identity, not only Congo, from what I've been reading. So perhaps that's why he's doing so well in Burkina Faso. They're quite open to other artists from other countries as well.
Fernando, so far, I'm loving the Burkina Faso charts. Will that continue, though, as we hit number two? What do you reckon?
I'm not sure, actually. Because at number two, I have to say, he's kind of another current song. He's a rapper. His name is Hugo Boss. It's not Hugo Boss. It's H-U-G-U-O. I mean, clearly he was inspired by Hugo Boss, the brand, because he's kind of a rapper, but he's also an entrepreneur. I think he's even the owner of a restaurant. I couldn't really find the menu online, but he's a businessman. His album is called M Business 2.0. And the track is a very interesting title, and I'll tell you why after. This is Hugo Boss with Colombian. Ils n'ont pas idée de comment je pars et de comment je viens de loin. J'arrêterai de les traumatiser quand moi-même je l'aurais décidé. Je suis numéro 1, t'es le numéro 12. Quand j'arrive comme papier, les visas se passent. J'ai pas besoin d'être avec vous dans la couche, je suis la lead arrivée, je décide quand tu passes. À chaque problème, sa solution, je multiplie, je connais pas la division. I could actually make out some of the lyrics there. Just about. I'm not going to repeat them. I have actually some translations here for you.
Far away.
Because I didn't quite understand. He says, I'm determined like a Colombian. But then, of course, he needs to add Pablo Escobar. And he says, Pablo Escobar arrives in the race. I couldn't really understand that. But, you know, he's being inspired. Maybe he's watching Narcos like you do.
I think we can probably get where he's coming from. I like that one. I just can't stop thinking about his restaurant. If we have any listeners out there who can tell us more about the offering, the F&B offering at Ugoa Boss's restaurant, write to Fernando.
I would love that. Next time I'm in Ouagadougou, you know.
What's the thing to have?
Exactly.
What a distraction. It's making me think of lunch, Fernando. But first up, before we even countenance that, we need to talk about what is number one in Burkina Faso right now.
Number one is a bit sad, but I really love the song, actually. The singer, she's from Ivory Coast as well, which, again, very important music market. Her name is Roselyne Layo, and the song is called Donnez-nous un peu, which means give us a little. Let's have a listen.
Right. Rosaline, what do you make of that one, Fernando?
It's funny because if you don't...
You weren't dancing as much that one. I don't know why.
Well, because it's quite sad. The video for that song, she goes inside a bar. There are a lot of couples kissing. And then she's just alone and like looking around. And then I read the lyrics. It's basically the song's about finding a soulmate. But then here's one of the lyrics. By all means, we want to find our own soulmate somewhere. But apparently the soulmate is not looking for us. So, I mean, aww, she's lonely, you
poor
know.
Rosaline.
And everybody's together, partnered in the video, and she's alone. But she still can crack some great dance moves to it.
That's good.
It didn't really match, actually, in the video. Suddenly she goes on a very up-tempo kind of dance beat, and then she walks in this bar by herself. It's an interesting choice.
You know where Rosaline needs to go? To Hugo Boss's restaurant.
Maybe she'll find love there. Maybe with Hugo Boss. I don't know. Maybe they're married.
I feel like we should somehow make this happen.
Exactly.
Fancy a quick round trip to Ouagadougou, Fernando?
I would love that.
Yeah, maybe that's not such a good idea after all. Fernando, lovely stuff. Very much enjoyed this week's Global Countdown. There we were. Burkina Faso's chart brought to life by the irreplaceable Fernando Augusto Pacheco Faye. Thank you very much. Indeed, that is just about all we have time for on today's edition of The Briefing. The programme was produced by Carlotta Ribello and Rhys James. Our researcher was Lillian Fawcett. Our studio manager was Chris Blackwell. My thanks to them, one and all. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's noon in London, of course. That is your Thursday briefing. I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye and thanks for listening.